True confessions time. I'm the moderator, and I see in the program they have me listed as the speaker. So I'm not your speaker. As I was running, I live in Milwaukee, and as I was leaving town, I was trying to print out the emails indicating the list of speakers and their background so I could do a brief introduction. Of course, Yahoo Mail was not working this morning, so I'm really caught with my pants down here. So I guess I have to start out with the embarrassing question. Are any of the people present scheduled to be speakers?
No.
Oh, this is going to be delightful.
How many speakers were there supposed to be?
There were at least three.
Because it's only a 45-minute presentation.
Well, you know, I wish I could tell you more, but I'm... They asked me to cover for someone who was supposed to be the moderator for the workshop, but she couldn't make it suddenly, so would I do it? So I said, okay, I'd do it, and got a few follow-up emails, didn't foolishly fail to print them out at the time. And now I'm sitting here looking at each other, and I have a basic familiarity with IRV. I assume that, does everyone?
Well,
IRV?
Instant runoff voting.
Okay, it's called ranked choice voting here. And you are, what's your name?
Rick Cassell. I'm the person listed as the speaker.
Right, but and you're the only person listed.
Right.
Well, there's several different forms. I mean, there's a preference voting and an instant runoff voting. I mean, are there at least three different kinds of...
There's quite a few.
Yeah.
Well, I could have an informal discussion with you about IRV, what I know about it, which is more than the average person does, but not necessarily more than you do. I don't know what your backgrounds are. So why don't we just do a quick introduction? I'm Rick Cassell, I'm from Milwaukee. I come to this through third party electoral work. I'm interested in trying to break the two-party system, which I regard as basically a good cop, bad cop routine.
Mm-hmm.
So from that, I became aware of alternative voting systems. I had the experience back in the 70s of checking out books on what is now called instant runoff voting or single transferable vote from a public library in Milwaukee that hadn't been checked out in like 40 years or something. So that's how I got into it. So
I'm Peggy Hatfield, I'm from Madison, and I'm no help to anybody. I came to find out stuff, so. Sorry about that. I'm not
going to
be a resource for anything.
Bob Park of Madison, with WRDE, LP Low Power Radio.
I'm Michelle Swenson from Denver, Colorado. I know they did an initiative in Fort Collins in April for instant runoff voting. My understanding was you vote for your two favorite candidates. That was my understanding of how they did it, were doing their model. But apparently, the Chamber of Commerce put a lot of money against it in the last 2 weeks and defeated it. So, that's what I know about it.
When was the referendum?
In April.
April of this year.
We're missing our speakers.
Yes. Details.
Nancy Grant, Monterey Peninsula, California. San Francisco does have its own number.
The city does.
The city and county. I'm a Green Party member, and that's one of our platforms to have instant runoff voting, or whatever it's called.
Mm-hmm. Which part? You said Green Party?
Green Party.
And my name is Stephanie Steigerwalt, and I have the same concerns that you do, where I would really like to see us not continue to have a two-party system. I don't think very much can change until that happens. And I used to live in San Francisco, so when I saw that they passed that and have heard more about it from my friends who still live there, I would really like to help spread that message and learn more about it.
And where do you live now?
Madison.
I'm Joy Arnold. I'm from Kentucky, and I apologize. I was early. Now I'm late. But what did she just tell about that I missed?
Oh, this is...
Oh, we're just going around introducing ourselves.
Oh. But...
Let me catch you up as far as I can. My name's Rick Cassell. I'm listed as the speaker. I was asked not to be the speaker, but to be the moderator, because the original moderator was unable to make it. So at the last minute, they asked me if I would do that. I said, okay. And then to compound things, I failed to print out the follow-up emails that they sent me about our speakers so that I could introduce them to you, who haven't shown up, I guess.
That may be a moot point.
Yeah, right. And so that's where we're at. We were just introducing ourselves to each other. I mean, I can tell you what I know about IRV, and you know, we can take it from there. Instant runoff voting, it's gone by a number of different names over the years, but the basic concept, as I understand it, is that voters are given an opportunity to mark their ballots in a way that indicates their preference, their order of preference among the candidates. It doesn't sound like much, but that little bit of additional information really can transform the situation. And by indicating a preference, there's a number of ways of doing it, but generally, I'm from Milwaukee, and in Wisconsin, we've made the transition, I think, pretty universally from voting machines, punch cards, and all that, all of those methods over to what are generally called machine-readable paper ballots. They are roughly this size, they're made on cardstock. Voters vote with by completing an arrow with a pencil. Those are inserted into a machine. They have the advantage of being readable by a human being, and but also you can run them through a machine, and so they're you can count them more quickly. The variations of this system have been in use for, I think, somewhere like a century in places like Ireland and Australia. And the big drawback in a place like Ireland was, I think, they were counting them by hand exclusively. And so it took them quite a while to get the final results. In this country, I know that this sort of alternative voting system has been in use on and off in various places. I believe Cincinnati was one of the earlier adopters, and under that system, they elected their first black mayor. It was in use in New York City in at least in the 30s and 40s. There is a book called Communist Councilman from Harlem. It's about a man named, the first words in the title of that book may be Pete Cacchione, for those of you who are taking notes, I'll try to spell it, C-A-C-H-I-O-N, possibly a second N-E. And then after that, Communist Councilman from Harlem. And in that book, which I read some decades ago, there is a description about how the Communist Party was able to elect people to the council in New York City. Under the system, and you know the ins and outs of it. I mean, one of the changes that I've noticed in my reading of IRV is that it. I don't know if any of you have run for office under the current system, but you know, in a plurality vote system, either you get somebody's vote or you don't. In this sort of system, you might not get their first preference, but you might then get that voter's second preference. So I personally believe that the system has one of the effects of the system is to reduce negative campaigning, because if you badmouth another candidate, you may be alienating that candidate's supporters and cutting your own throat as a candidate. How many preferences you can indicate, the person from Denver, right? And mm-hmm. You said that in Fort Collins they had a referendum on it and they could mark for two. For two favorites. Well, I think it was in San Francisco. I thought I saw a ballot, of an image of a ballot from San Francisco in which it looked pretty similar to what we had in Wisconsin, except that it was duplicated in several columns. And it was marked first preference for the first column and then second preference in the second column. The columns themselves were identical, but the voters were marking them the same group of candidates at least three different ways.
I thought it was three times too.
Right, yeah. It can be. It depends on how it's implemented. But the basic idea is for voters to be able to indicate preferences. And that it doesn't, like I said, it didn't seem like much, but that additional amount, that's a tremendous additional amount of information that the voter is communicating through his or her ballot. And it has had some pretty dramatic impact.
You can eliminate runoff elections.
Right,
It's one big advantage, but I think it needs to be pointed out. Now, again, the structure of elections varies a lot in this country from one state to the next. In Wisconsin, we have partisan as well as nonpartisan elections. And the everything at the municipal level and at the county board level is in, and the county executive and the counties that have them in the state, those are all officially nonpartisan elections. And history trivia lovers, does anyone know why? Because in 19, as you leave the building in the area, the check-in area, at the moment there is a poster up in a frame, a wooden frame, which I wrote a year ago to commemorate a political upheaval in my town of Milwaukee. In April of 1910, the Socialist Party went from electing a few aldermen that it had done over the years to sweeping the elections. And in April 1910, the Socialist Party elected their first mayor in Milwaukee, plus in Wisconsin we have several, in a city, you have several citywide officers. You have mayor, comptroller, treasurer, and city attorney. In 1910, the what was then called the Social Democratic Party swept all of those races in Milwaukee, plus a majority on the county, on the Common Council, the alder people, and the county board as well. That all happened in April 1910, and in shortly thereafter, the Democrats and Republicans in the state legislature changed the law in Wisconsin to make municipal elections nonpartisan. Well, the first change was that party labels, the names of parties, would not appear with the candidates. If they could use a slogan, and so it was something like public ownership of public utilities. That was the Social Democratic or Socialist label. And then they changed it to have no labels at all. And do you know why?
You couldn't vote a street ticket.
I'm sorry, what?
You couldn't vote a street ticket.
Not only that, you couldn't vote a street ticket because there weren't party tickets, but in a nonpartisan, in a partisan system with a three-way split, the Social Democrats were able to elect with a plurality of a little over a third. When it went to a nonpartisan system, that meant there was a runoff, and therefore you had to have 50% plus one. Mm-hmm. So that was a successful technique that the Democrats and Republicans used to stop the Socialists for a while. Eventually, they were able to elect other mayors. If you look at the poster as you leave, you'll see that they elected Milwaukee Socialists elected mayors from 1910 to 1960 for 38 of those 50 years. And the first 2 years were under the partisan system, and then after that under the supposedly nonpartisan system.
So was it the state legislature that took away Milwaukee's right for this?
Yes.
Because obviously you're in power, you're not going to change it.
Right. No, it was the state legislature that did that. And although you'll find people that live in Wisconsin that think that the switch to a nonpartisan system was part of the progressive movement, at least around here, it was done in order to wipe out the socialists. So there's historically been a lot of game playing. Once government started printing the ballots in, I would say, the late 1890s in this country, and it was originally called an Australian ballot because I think Australia was the first place to have the government print the ballots, as opposed to before that when political parties, candidates, whatever, they'd print their own ballots, and I don't know if they were pre-marked, but they would hand them out to people and say, you want to support this ticket? Just stick this in the urn. And then once the government started printing it, then of course the whole question became who was allowed to appear on the government printed ballots. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know, is this information useful to you, or?
There's something else called ranked voting, I think, where you rank all of the candidates instead of just.
That's what this is headed, isn't it?
I don't know, instant runoff, I've always thought it was choosing two, because that's what I heard, but then there's ranked voting and preference voting.
There's a whole lot of ways of, there are many different alternatives. I mean, I don't associate instant runoff voting or a single transferable ballot with a limited number of two. This is what you said was the first time I'd heard that.
Yeah, well, a friend of mine too talked about choosing. Kind of a pass fail. You know, where you rank everybody pass fail, which is not very gratifying because it's not a very accurate measurement. You know, it's like you rank them yes or no or something, you know, kind of thing.
There is an alternative system that I have heard is theoretically superior to instant runoff or single transferable voting. Condorcet or something is the name of it. I have only the vaguest recollection of it, though. The other thing that I recall about that system was that the math involved was, I thought, on the complicated side, and that would be enough to be a killer for it from my standpoint. I mean, it's
it needs to be simple.
Yeah, I think it has to be something that you could, if we're going to be able to sell something politically, I think it has to be something that the average person can understand. Especially because these days where, you know, in a lot of parts of the country, there's been a transition made to touchscreen computer balloting, and that which I regard as extremely dangerous. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with the phrase black box voting.
Yeah.
You know, that's something, if you're not, you should probably jot that down. Black box voting. It's about, there's all sorts of websites that are out there. There's a book titled Black Box Voting: Vote Tampering in the 21st Century. And basically these systems can be rigged. Mm-hmm. And especially because the code, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Can we change that to were, are?
Are, right. Because
instead,
you know,
it can be.
Right.
Documented cases across the country.
Right. The companies that manufacture those systems, and this is getting a little off subject, I don't know if it's of interest to you, but a lot of these companies not only have very partisan leanings in terms of the political contributions of their owners, but they also, I think, pretty much universally say that the code that they use to program the machine is a trade secret.
Mm-hmm.
So at the heart of our democracy is something that's secret,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, I think is obviously on its face mm-hmm. intolerable. So the voting has, the various jurisdictions have adopted these alternative voting systems, and usually whichever political party lost as a consequence fought to abolish it. What comes to mind is Ann Arbor, Michigan. They had a form of instant runoff voting. I don't know the specifics, but I do recall that I don't know if you folks remember a political party that existed in the mid-1970s called the People's Party. This is not the historic People's Party of the populist movement of a century ago, but there was another group that, to which the, in California, for example, the Peace and Freedom Party was affiliated. It was an anti-war, sort of a generic left party that got going in the 70s, and their Michigan affiliate was called the Human Rights Party. And they were able to elect in Ann Arbor a number of people under this system. The new system meant that the Republicans were basically dead meat in that area, and so they, of course, were the ones that fought to get rid of it and go back. So, you know, it's going to be a constant struggle to get these things. I personally think that it would make the most sense tactically to get a broad movement going in any given jurisdiction that does not include simply people that are interested in third parties. Because there are reasons to adopt a system like this, like you were talking about with the no runoff, the economy. However, it would have to be at least here in Wisconsin, you'd have to have that system, IRV or whatever you call it, adopted for all of the elections that are being held in a given election cycle. Otherwise, you wouldn't have those savings. You know what I'm talking about? For example, here in Wisconsin, in a spring officially nonpartisan election cycle, you could have candidates for municipal office, alders and mayor, county board, plus county executive if there's one in that county, plus some judicial races, plus maybe superintendent of public instruction, and superior court races. And if any of them were on the old system of having to have a runoff, then you wouldn't have any savings. They would all have to be under the new system.
Is there any reason why the nonpartisan positions offices could not be ranked voting?
No, not at all. In fact, I think that tactically that would make the most sense.
That makes the sense that you don't have that problem.
Right.
Everybody.
And I think, you know, from my experience in dealing with presidential primaries, at least here in Wisconsin, I think that, that's something, it's a concept that could catch on, because typically when you're, whichever party doesn't hold the presidency has a lot of candidates, and there can be like a quite a broad field. You know, I'm thinking back into the 70s where you had, and I'll probably start confusing the years in question, but you know, you had a Udall running, plus a McGovern, plus Eugene McCarthy in a Democratic primary, plus Hubert Humphrey, plus, you know, I mean, there was quite a spectrum, and probably when you've got that many candidates, a given voter would be interested in, would have some affinity to more than one of those candidates. Sure, go ahead.
Well, you know, my thought was that to overcome, I'm trying to think of all the way, any way to overcome corporate money in politics. And so I was thinking this is one way, possibly like free media for serious candidates, or I'm just trying to think of how to get around this Citizens United, you know, the undisclosed money.
What, you want a functioning democracy in the United States?
Well, we haven't seen that for a while.
Right.
Probably for a long time. Yeah. No, but I was just trying to think of all the ways that we might be able to, you know, what else was I thinking? But anyway, those are two of the ways I thought of.
Well, yeah, there are many different parts, pieces to the puzzle from my standpoint.
One way media controls the two-party system is it prevents third-party candidates or alternative parties from being on any debate or anything. So
you know what? I really love Democracy Now! And the Real Network News, but because the corporate media has been so bad, I've talked to so many people here who you would think would have heard of the People's Budget. But nobody has heard of it because the mainstream media is not talking about it, and it was written by the 80-person Progressive Caucus, you know, in Congress. And it would reduce the deficit quicker than any other proposal around, you know, and without the pain that they're inflicting on people. So the Real Network News can be found online, and I get emails from them regularly about interviews that they've done, like with economists that you never hear in the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. You know, and that kind of thing. And they really explain the whole thing the way it is, the way it's happened, mm-hmm. who's at fault. And
before I forget, let me, if anyone is interested, I will leave a stack or a few of my cards. I have a list that I assembled recently of alternative radio shows and or podcasts that are broadly distributed. I don't know if you're familiar with Counterspin. Mm-hmm. Counterspin, Making Contact, that sort of thing, as well as a few daily ones, including the two that you mentioned, Democracy Now! And the Real Network News. If anyone would like a copy of the list, I've got a few more cards. You can just send me an email. I've got a few more cards I can give the rest of you, and I'll be happy to send you that. I also have a list of Yahoo groups that I personally distribute news to on a pretty much a daily basis. And if you want, you can ask, you know, just ask them for that list too.
Thank you very much.
So yeah, I guess from my standpoint, there's a tactical question that is going to be based on your particular part of the country. And your state specifically, and your own, you know, city, in terms of a tactical question of how to build something like this. There have been sporadic attempts here in Wisconsin to have, you know, to push for IRV. The problem is, like with anything else, having a sustained effort over time, because it's not, you know, none of these changes, at least in my experience, have happened very quickly. So there has to be an ongoing effort, you know, an ongoing push. It doesn't have to be frenetic all the time, but you got to have staying power. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. You know,
I heard this morning a woman from Wisconsin talking about from Move to Mend, and they did they collected ballot signatures to put on the ballot an initiative to counter Citizens United. You know, in several cities, or the county and the city, but. I was just wondering, like, if you're doing a campaign like that, why make it a comprehensive campaign and say, you know, these are the things we need to counter, you know, and make it a chance to educate people,
right,
you know, about how to counter this decision.
Yeah, I found very little resistance to it, the concept of IRV. The main problem that you're dealing with in promoting an alternative voting system, in my experience, for what it's worth, has been ignorance, has been just a total lack of familiarity with the whole concept. Mm-hmm. And once I happened to be in South America at the end of June, and I asked around there among my political contacts and found that even among people involved in partisan politics in places like Chile and Argentina, this was not something that they'd even heard of. Mm-hmm. So, and in this country, you know, the old saying, ignorance is bliss, and the American people have historically been very happy.
Ignorance is blissful.
Right. So I think that, you know, you have to look at what part of the country you live in and think about how to build if you're going to build a movement for this sort of change, I think tactically it has to not be seen, because you're trying to get a state legislature to adopt this. If it is seen...
Well, if you're trying to put it on a ballot directly with signatures...
Well,
you can do that too.
Right. Mm-hmm. In some states, you can do that. But here in Wisconsin, where we like to pat ourselves on the back as being the home of progressive politics and Bob La Follette and all that, we've never had that.
Oh, you never have.
We've never had, at the state level, initiative and referendum. And what we do have is really difficult to achieve. I can give you, is this sort of anecdote useful to you?
Oh, yeah.
In Milwaukee, we had... maybe 10, was this 10 years ago or more, there was a move to push for a new stadium. We had a stadium that worked perfectly well for multiple sports, but the Milwaukee Brewers wanted a new stadium with a retractable roof and all this stuff. Right, okay, so this should ring bells across the country.
Yeah.
But get this, right at about this time, we had a referendum in the city of Milwaukee to float a bond issue for the purpose of renovating century-old public school buildings. And it went down big time.
Oh.
And it wasn't even close. Within a few months of that going down big time, without a vote of anyone except in the state legislature, they passed a bill that said that in something like 5 or 6 counties, we were all gonna have to pay an additional income sales tax to build this new stadium, and the profits from that stadium, if any, would go to the Milwaukee Brewers. The losses were handed to the taxpayer.
Oh, wow.
You've heard the expression, heads I win, tails you lose?
Wow. Well, and we voted on it, and it passed in Colorado.
Right. Yeah. So, well, I was looking for a way to have people vote on it, because I'm thinking this really, frankly, pissed me off as a just as a citizen, and I'm looking, and there was no organized opposition to it. Some church groups had done a little bit, put out a bumper sticker or two, but that was about it. There was hardly anything visible in the media, and the media was cheering us on because, of course, the local media was going to be making, you know, their money from professional sports as well. And so I went to my copy of the state election code, and I'm looking through it, and I found the part about having a referendum, and I got out my calculator and looked up the statistics. In Wisconsin, the law says that if you want to have a referendum in a given area, all you have to do is collect a number of signatures in whatever jurisdiction you want to hold the referendum, city, county, whatever, that the number of signatures had to be equal to 1/5 of the number of votes cast for governor in the previous election. And in the city of Milwaukee alone, this was some years ago, but don't hold me to the exact figure, but it was something over 50,000 signatures. Mm-hmm. And I thought, forget it, this is not gonna happen. And then finally, a dim light bulb goes off, and I remembered another section of the state election code. So I go back to the book and I flip through it, and I found, sure enough, it said that, remember we were talking about, you know, who could appear on the ballot and who couldn't. Okay, in Wisconsin, in those days, they had, it's still basically on the books, if you run as an independent in a partisan election, you can have, the candidate can have on his or her nomination papers up to 5 words to describe his or her principle or party. So after I read this, I got myself down to Summerfest, which is a festival held in a municipally owned spot on Lake Michigan coast in Milwaukee. And within, I think, a weekend, I had enough signatures to put my name on the ballot for county treasurer with the phrase, no new taxpayer-subsidized stadium.
Oh, wow.
I spent basically nothing. I was denounced by name in the editorial pages of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, which is, I figure, you know, one of the surest signs that I was on the right track. They never responded to my request for a plaque that said that I'm an SOB. But and I got this was at this point. This was in the 1980s. Milwaukee County was making the transition. In Milwaukee County, every municipality had its own ballot form. It wasn't just different in every municipality, but those decisions were made at the municipal level. The city of Milwaukee had gone from the voting machines, which were terrible for any independent or third-party candidate, to the machine-readable paper ballot. You're familiar with the phrase, the law of unintended consequences? Mm-hmm. Well, when they went to the new form of ballot, they're arranged by office, not by party. The old voting machines were a crosshatch of, on one side you had the parties, and on the other you had the offices. So in that election cycle, there was a pretty strong correlation between whether a municipality had gone to the new ballots and my vote. It was something like, I got nothing less than 13% in those elections, in those municipalities, and nothing more than like 7% in the ones that were still using the old systems. And in fact, after the election, I happened to be in the city hall of one of those suburbs, and it was a day or two after the election, they still had the voting machine sitting there with the curtains open. So I went over, and I'm about 6 feet tall. I go over, and I'm looking for, it's my name, all right? I know I'm on the ballot. I'm looking, and I could not find my name on the ballot until I kneel down like this. Then and only then could I find my name at the very bottom line. So that was, you know, these voting systems, people think like it's a technicality or something. It's not. It has a very dramatic effect on your vote. In that election cycle, one of the municipalities in Milwaukee County is named Hales Corners. I never set foot in Hales Corners during that entire election cycle. I got between 20 and 25% of the vote there.
Wow.
Okay. So and they had gone to the new voting system, you know, to the new ballots. So my name was right next to the incumbent's name in those. So I don't know if this isn't the real IRV related directly, but I don't know if it's useful to you or not.
Go ahead.
Is there any discussion of our going to not just a third party situation, but multiple parties like the Europeans have, and percentage of representation,
parliamentary form of government?
What I would, I'll tell you, I'll, let me throw this okay. little concept out, and I don't want to dominate the conversation, but in my experience, and I've been involved in third party electoral work since the 1970s, the average person, including the average, let's say, member of the Democratic Party, is open to these things. Once, as you go up in the power structure, at least of the Democratic Party, from what I have seen, there is a greater awareness of these alternative voting systems, and there is a very noticeable antipathy towards them. Because the people that actually run these political parties, and if we're talking about the Democrats, I'm talking about people like Rahm Emanuel, I'm not talking about the rank and file Democrats who are politically probably closer to me than they are to their leaders, but the people, the cynics that actually run the Democratic Party, they understand that they are getting votes only because of an anti-Republican sentiment,
exactly.
Not because people love the Democratic Party.
Absolutely.
And that was the comment I was going to make earlier, that in terms of in California, we do have an initiative process. And so many people, you know, they're voting for the least least...
The lesser two evils.
The lesser two evils, thank you very much. And so...
Also called the evil of two lessers. That's an old saying, too. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist.
Thank you. Anyway, so I would think getting, instead of not voting on the ballot would be fairly easy because of the dissatisfaction across all the spectrum, electrical spectrum.
Well, how did it come to pass in San Francisco? Do you know the history?
I don't know.
Because I left there in 2001 and it didn't exist then. And
I know, it's new, it's
yeah,
very new.
Exactly.
Now, what is it that's new?
And I used to
they have instant runoff voting in San Francisco.
Can I throw out a quick suggestion for those of you that are taking notes? Fairvote.org, spelled as one word, fairvote.org, fairvote.org. That is the Center for Voting and Democracy, which was founded, I think, by that mayor, that former mayor of Cincinnati, and it was later led and is currently, I think, led by John Anderson, who had been the independent presidential candidate in 1980. They have a great website with a wealth of information on this. You could probably get the answer to that question about how IRV was adopted in any given location. If they don't have it already on their website, an email would probably say, look here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Right. Center for
Voting and Democracy.
No, wait a minute, you said fairvote.org.
That's their website, it's called fairvote.org.
Center for
the organization is called the Center for Voting and Democracy.
That would be a very long URL.
Yeah.
Wouldn't fit in our business card.
Center for Open?
Center for Voting and Democracy. But if you just do
you
fairvote.org, that'll get you there.
Okay.
I'm going to throw this out for what it's worth. This is really getting far afield from IRV. But personally, I am convinced that one of the most significant triumphs of the plutocracy that calls the shots in this country has been their successful theft of our history. Mm-hmm. By trade, I'm a Spanish interpreter. That's what I do for a living. And if I find it basically impossible to ask, for example, a Mexican, who is Emiliano Zapata? And find somebody from Mexico who would say, Zapata sounds familiar, but I can't tell you this. Yet other historic figures in this country who were pretty important during their lifetime, like Eugene Debs, you get a, who is Debs, kind of response. So if you're looking for general suggestions on how to raise political consciousness, I want to throw out the idea of educating people about our history. I assume, maybe I'm wrong, I don't know, would everyone here be familiar with Howard Zinn? Mm-hmm. He died of like a year or two ago. He wrote A People's History of the United States. Mm-hmm. What I like to do is I stop by places like Half Price Books. I don't know if in your parts of the country they've got them. Mm-hmm. I'm so cheap, I go straight to the clearance section. Mm-hmm. And I buy, where nothing's over $3, and I buy books and DVDs that I think are politically eye-opening. I then go home, put on the Goo Gone to take off the labels. And a lot of these are hardcover. A lot of them are in perfect shape. I then donate them to public libraries and high school libraries and jail libraries. Now, in Wisconsin, a jail library is not going to take a book that's hardcover if they have some sort of security problem with that. Mm-hmm. But they will take, generally, they will take anything that's softcover. And in fact, some years ago, I came across, I think it was 8 copies of Noam Chomsky's book, The Year 500, in Spanish.
Whoa.
I got at least one note from a sheriff thanking me. Huh. Now, I don't think he would have thanked me if I'd given it to him in English, if he bothered to read it. But this was in Spanish, so if you could find Spanish books, there are books. In fact, for some reason, the Spanish version of The People's History of the United States is cheaper than the English version. Mm-hmm. It's published by Seven Stories Press out of New York, but you can get it in bulk at a lower price. Then you can get the English version. There are other books that you can get in Spanish as well as English that would really go over. And because in a lot of jails, the people that are there can read only Spanish, and all they've got are like romance novels and the Bible. And so I have found that when I give them there, they're very popular, let's put it that way. There's another book called Addicted to War, which is a cartoon format exploration of American foreign policy that is also available in Spanish. And it's at a at a fairly simple vocabulary level, so pretty much anyone can observe it. Sorry, I just had to throw it.
Well, no, I just have to do this one. And it's from their home countries, the invasions that we
Oh, right.
What now?
When they're reading it in the U.S. prison, it's talking about the countries, their home countries that we invaded.
Right. And go ahead.
What third parties are actually getting on the ballot in Milwaukee these days?
Well, again, in Wisconsin, municipal elections are nonpartisan.
Right.
So do you mean which third parties run candidates in those elections, or do you mean in the partisan elections for non-municipal office?
Just wondering what parties you were involved with in your work in Milwaukee.
In my lifetime, I have been involved with, I guess I have the distinction of being the last person to grow up in the Milwaukee socialist tradition. Mm-hmm. So I was involved in that party from the time that I was in high school. I asked, I was doing actually some family tree research, and I came across somebody my father didn't want to talk about. So, you know, with any kid, that's going to make him real curious about that. And I eventually learned that my great-grandfather was a socialist in Nebraska at the turn of the century, who went from Catholicism to atheism during World War I, had the honor of having federal agents come to his house and tell him to shut the hell up about his opposition to World War I. And so then I came across, and to this day I'm shocked that it was there in my junior high school, David Shannon's book, The Socialist Party of America, which I wasn't familiar with Howard Zinn's A People's History at that point, and I don't know whether it had been published at that point, but this was very much like that in the sense of being eye-opening. If you want to read about the stuff that wasn't in your high school history textbook, that wasn't a bad place to start. And then I asked Frank Zeidler, who was the third socialist mayor of Milwaukee, to come and speak to my high school class. And then so I was involved in that sort of thing. I had also been active to some degree in the Green Party, and before that in Wisconsin we had the Labor Farm Party, not the Farmer Labor Party, which was in Minnesota, but in the 1980s a group of Wisconsin public sector unions were looking for someone to run against Bill Proxmire, who was bad on privatization type issues. And so they brought an old socialist out of retirement named Bill Hart and had him run for Senate. And I think it was sometime in the early 1980s against Proxmire. And because, as I mentioned before, if you run as an independent, you can have up to 5 words on the ballot. So they looked at each other and said, well, what do we put? And they put Labor and Farm Party. And that candidate got enough of the vote, which is 1% in a statewide race, so that phrase then became a political party on the ballot in Wisconsin. But that whole concept of ballot status was really a big deal during the days of voting machines. As I was giving you that example, that crosshatch, mm-hmm. because they would put, generally, the states would put those parties on the ballot in order of their vote. Now, during the progressive era here in Wisconsin, there was a law which was repealed later that varied the ballot position in ward by ward by ward, because really stupid people don't vote, but there are some of them do, and so there are some people that will vote based on just the order of the candidate appears on the ballot. So to reduce that, there was a reform enacted here under the progressives that varied the ballot position, in every, from one ward to the next, to reduce that phenomenon. There's a number of things here that were repealed, that we used to have.
Good.
And if you're interested in this trivia, I'll throw one last thing at you. Wisconsin has a state life insurance company called the State Life Fund, which hardly anyone has heard of. In the early 1900s, there was a scandal involving the life insurance industry. I don't know the details, but it was some, like what we had with the housing industry in the last few years. It hit the insurance industry. And so the progressive Republicans, in alliance with the Social Democrats, passed a bill that created a state-owned life insurance company. The Wisconsin Commissioner of Insurance, which is the state agency that supposedly regulates insurance companies in this state, also administers this fund. This fund has to pay rent as if it were a commercial company, it operates and its rates are designed only to cover its cost. So it costs the taxpayers nothing, and it provides, I think, the cheapest life insurance in the state of Wisconsin, but hardly anyone has heard about it. Because when the Democrats and Republicans came back into power, they weren't able to kill it directly. They killed it sort of indirectly by not allowing the amount of insurance offered to go up. So I think it's capped at like $6,000. So it'll bury you, but that's about it. And they also forbade the Commissioner of Insurance from using any taxpayer money to inform the people of Wisconsin of the existence of the fund. So it's there, but people don't know about it.
Can you prevent him from talking about it?
He can talk about it, he just can't spend any money to let people know about it.
So that's available to the public.
Isn't that one of the things Walker did away with, though?
Not to my knowledge. If he's actually managed to get rid of the state life fund, that's news to me.
I don't know, I thought that it was the Commissioner of Insurance that doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, no. Well, I haven't heard that either.
Okay.
It's maybe that I'm not informed.
In February, with some of the other stuff that they did, I thought that was one of the offices they did away with.
Usually what they do is it's something more subtle in terms, instead of actually getting rid of an office, it's, you know, the subversion. I don't know how many...
Defund it. So.
Right. Well, how many of you follow Matt Taibbi, RollingStone.com? Matt Taibbi, T-A-I-B-B-I.
Oh,
he's really good.
He's good.
He had an article on the Securities and Exchange Commission within the last week or two. Matt, M-A-T-T, T-A-I-B-B-I. He's really, really good.
T-A-I-B-B-I.
Yeah.
And he's at
Rolling Stone.
Taibbi.
Yeah, I know that name.
RollingStone.com.
News.
The article is about the Securities and Exchange Commission, apparently in violation of federal law, has been taking the evidence that they have, if they come across something that might be a criminal activity, the law enforcement agencies, when they do that, will universally keep, even if it doesn't result in a formal charge, they'll keep the evidence in a file somewhere. So that, as Matt Taibbi put it in the beginning of this latest article, you know, a detective will say, hey, Sergeant, did you realize that this suspect had two wives die mysteriously? Okay, they're able to do that because they keep their data. And federal law requires them to do so. But Taibbi, in his latest essay, said that apparently, in violation of that law, the Securities and Exchange Commission hasn't been doing that.
Oh my gosh.
It's basically been another one of these situations where money subverts the purpose of an agency.
Mm-hmm.
It's really worth reading. His stuff is I think, terrific.
Yeah, they actually had a whistleblower, one of the guys involved
right.
in the SEC enforcement part of the SEC. There are investigations that don't matriculate into a full-blown investigation. They sort
or
of
criminal charge, right.
Yeah, and they're sort of dumping all that stuff. But a year ago, yeah, after this guy, he's been blowing the whistle for like several years, and nothing's been done, except last year they finally agreed to stop doing that.
And what they're saying is, we haven't destroyed everything, which means that there's like a computer listing, a one-line, like five words that say, date, maybe agency investigate or something, but everything else, the actual evidence, thrown out, shredded.
Wow.
So I hope you found it
Thank you.
A useful thing.
Thank
Let's
you.
Get it on the fly.
Yeah, really appreciate it.
Put
on the spot.
Well,
I think it worked very well.
Yes.
Thank you.
And take a look at the poster as you leave, if you get in the registration area.
If any of you are interested, there's a very good session going right now until 2:30 on election integrity just next door. And I already asked them.
Till 2:30?
Or until 3:30, sorry. Yeah, anyway, I assume if we can. I can put that in the
list. Yeah, there's going to be another one here. Okay.
You never got to hear what you would thought of what might have happened in Florida when Gore was running against Bush, if there were instant runoff allowing people to put Gore as a second choice when they voted for Nader.
Well, did you read the New York Times series after the election where they usually the New York Times, I think their reputation is overblown for investigative journalism, but they had something after, when was it? This would have been then like in the spring of 2001, where they actually had photographs. What had happened clearly was that the Republicans, and you know, when I hear people talk about the Republicans being stupid, I think wait a minute, these they may be evil, but stupid
right.
They're not. They're really not. If they're stupid, then what does that make us? Because these guys had figured out in advance the racial composition of every military base in Florida. And the election code in Florida had like a whole a number of requirements to for a ballot a mail-in ballot to be counted. There were like let's say a dozen, right? And they actually the New York Times actually had photographs of the envelopes that the ballots arrived in, and like here is photo number one. Republican poll watchers insist that this not be counted, and there were like at more than half a dozen characteristics that it had to have. And it had all of them, but the Republicans said, no, we cannot count this. Then they had photo number two, different base, and it's all the same things were there. Republicans insisted it must be counted, okay? And the Republicans knew the racial composition of the military base. They were outlawed. They were outsmarted. You know, blaming Nader is, you know, it's relatively easy to blame somebody like Nader and say, oh, it's all his fault. But the reality is that they were outsmarted by the Republicans.
Gosh.
Nice meeting you all. See you.